program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, The Joy of Underperforming by Olga Kazan. For many of us, the vitamin D deprived, the sugar addled, perhaps the suddenly jobless or those dreading family gatherings, 'tis the season not so much to be jolly, but to just be in a season. The phrase has become a common way of talking yourself through a sudden upheaval, or of explaining that you'll be doing things a little differently for a while. You might have noticed this phrasing if you are a Christian or run in Christian-adjacent circles, where it seems to be especially prominent. Many believers tend to say that they are, for example, quote, going through a hard season, end quote, or are in a, quote, season of singleness, end quote, a reference to the Ecclesiastes verse, to everything there is a season. I'm in a season where the kids need the best of me, not the rest of me, explained Elizabeth Hasselbeck when she left Fox News in 2015. This concept of seasons has now spread far beyond Christianity to mainstream mental health and self-help. Invoking it has become a signal that you're too overwhelmed to meet some expectation or another. I'm in a season of not reading as much, the artist Caroline Kent told the New York Times when asked mid-pandemic about her current book list. Although it may seem cheesy or evasive on its face, the expression is a healthy way to interpret the times when doing it all or to pleasing everyone simply isn't possible. In fact, thinking of life in terms of seasons might just be the best way to stay sane during times of change. Often in life, we are firing on all cylinders, notching promotions, getting the holiday cards sent out before December 20. But each of us invariably goes through a slower season, too. In her best-selling book, Wintering, Catherine May explains that though we tend to wish that life would be an endless, unvarying high season, there will often come a fallow period in life when you're cut off from the world, feeling rejected, sidelined, blocked from progress, or cast into the role of an outsider. She points out that for most people, wintering is inevitable. For May, wintering arrived at her 40th birthday when both she and her husband fell ill and her son began refusing to attend school. But even if you've never experienced a serious illness or setback, your parents will die, your job will change, your plans will go awry, and something will have to give. Winter is coming, whether you want it to or not. Even in a challenging time, though, the idea of seasons is hopeful, suggesting that there can be periods of your life when you emphasize different things, family, work, hobbies, friendship, and not one or two of the others can shrink for a while. The birth of a baby is an obvious one, but many things can prompt a shift in seasons, a graduation, a breakup, a new job, moving to a new city. This might mean that your life sometimes seems unbalanced because you are, out of a necessity, paying more attention to some realms than others. A layoff might make a career woman turn into, for a time, a stay-at-home mom. A demanding new job might make that same woman a less involved parent for a few months. But looking across the entirety of your life, the peaks and valleys of work, family, and self-care can even out to a balance. People tend to misinterpret balance as needing to do everything, says Brad Stuhlberg, an executive coach whose latest book is Master of Change. I need to be the perfect partner, the perfect parent, the perfect employee, the perfect friend. I need to have orchids and follow Game of Thrones and have a fantasy football team, and on and on. I think a much more realistic and attainable version is to have your priorities and your emphasis ebb and flow with your life. This isn't a new concept, of course, just one that seems to have gained traction recently among the burned-out keyboard class. Thousands of years ago, the Buddha taught that permanence is one of the marks of existence, and that understanding this is one of the secrets to enlightenment. I once had a meditation teacher who liked to remind her students that this too shall pass is both relieving and somber. Nothing bad lasts forever, but neither does anything good. No one is quite sure why seasons took off among Christians, only that it has. During the pandemic, Amber Reynolds, a history professor at Wheaton College, noticed a rise in email greetings that said something like, "I hope this finds you well in this season," a nod to the difficult temporary period we were all living through. Reynolds says the usage is meant to express, "This is a challenging time, but it's an expectation that it will be temporary. God will put you through this winter of life, but there will be hope in the future." Of course, you could just say you're in a phase of life, but these imply time horizons that are either too short or too long. A season feels more apt, a few months, give or take. The transitoriness is built into the word, and that makes it edifying. This metaphor can be helpful if you, like me, struggle to endure an actual season of the year. I have seasonal affective disorder, which means that the winter draws me into depression, anxiety, and exhaustion. When the freezing rains of February lash the East Coast, it feels to me like winter will last forever. It also sometimes feels that way to Daryl Van Tongeren, a psychology professor who grew up in California but now teaches in Michigan at Hope College. "There are times in which winter honestly feels like it's never going to end," he told me. "But eventually tulips will push up through the frost. Every single year, without fail, we always manage to get out of winter." He said, "Winter to us is an interminable season, but it's also only a season." As Marilynne Robinson put it, "The spirit of the times is one of joyless urgency." I think it's a little existentially threatening to think that everything lasts a season, Van Tongeren said, because then we might extrapolate that out to realize our life is just a series of seasons that will also end. Eliminating or stepping back from things may feel unnatural because the human is not a minimalistic animal. When faced with a problem, people are more likely to remove elements than to add them, according to research by Lydie Klotz, a professor at the University of Virginia and the author of Subtract. "People have a natural desire to exhibit competence," he says, "and it's harder to display your smarts by not doing things." In one experiment, he and his co-authors presented study participants with a packed itinerary for a trip to Washington, D.C. Over 14 hours, the itinerary had the participants visiting 6 different buildings, 3 different memorials, a museum, a shop, and a bistro. Then, they had to give the participants the option to add or subtract activities. Only about a quarter opted to remove some. To overcome this tendency, Klotz recommends focusing on what you gain by subtracting, on what your life will look like when you have one less meeting to attend or one less kitchen tool to find space for. He suggests temporarily removing a standing commitment from your schedule just to see if anything breaks. "We're just going to try it, and if something bad happens, we'll just add the thing back in," he explained in an interview. You can stop subtracting once you start missing what's been cut. The key, however, is not to let a season of pulling back on certain commitments mean that you never focus on those areas of your life again. Prioritizing work for a few months might be necessary, but prioritizing work for a lifetime could be pathological. And you should probably sneak in some time with your kids, even while you're sprinting through a work tunnel. Stolberg recommends viewing your identity as a house, one in which you might spend most of your time within just one or two rooms for a while, but you don't want to let the other rooms go so unused for so long that they fall into disrepair. Even parenting, which seems like something you can't overdo, eventually ends. When your kids move out, you'll want other elements of your identity, hobbies or friends, to dwell in. Or take the analogy of a 3-ring circus, put to me by Laura Vanderkam, an author who specializes in work-life balance. You might have one main event, but the other rings of your life still have something going on. If you've got one ring where there's a giant sphere where people are riding eight motorbikes around in the center of it, Vanderkam told me, maybe in one of the others there's a clown juggling. Something simpler, but still extant. This can be useful advice when you feel like the clown who's juggling. Sometimes this can mean changing your focus with the time of year, literally the season. Vanderkam, who has interviewed several accountants for her books, said they tend to go to the dentist and see all their friends in December, before clients start seeking their help in January. Then they would kind of check out again until April, she said. They settle in for their own personal winter, tax season. Next, college football's Super PACs produced this championship game. By Jamel Hill. Fan support is a big reason the University of Washington Huskies and University of Michigan Wolverines will play in college football's championship game this week in Houston. That support isn't just emotional, it's also financial. For decades, college athletes received only scholarships as compensation until legal changes forced the NCAA to let them profit from their own name, image, and likeness. The new NIL era allows individual athletes to accept endorsement deals. But at colleges and universities all around the country, something else has happened. Fan-supported collectives have sprouted up to help teams stay competitive by providing broad categories of players with thousands of dollars in cash apiece, ostensibly for their marketing value rather than for their performance on the field. Looking at how this season's four-team college football playoff unfolded, Huskies and Wolverines fans would probably agree that their money was well spent. Michigan, for example, was initially slower than the other big-name athletic programs to embrace collectives. Now the university has multiple collectives at its disposal, including the Champions Circle, an official partner of the school's athletic department. In 2022, Champions Circle raised $7.5 million for the football team. If not for Valiant Management Group, which was founded by former Wolverines fullback Jared Rangler, and bills itself as the leading sports marketing agency representing University of Michigan student athletes, some of Michigan's key players might not have returned this year to compete for a national championship. After the Wolverines lost to Texas Christian University at last year's Fiesta Bowl, Valiant launched the One More Year Fund to entice Michigan players with NFL prospects to remain with the team. Funds like these are the college sports equivalent of political action committees, or PACs. Other top programs have had similar assistance. A collective called Montlake Futures helped Washington retain its core players, including the quarterback and Heisman Trophy runner-up Michael Penix Jr. The University of Texas, the team that Washington beat in the Sugar Bowl to advance to the championship game, has the Texas One Fund, which paid $14 million to Texas football players since 2021. The money that fans are pouring into their teams is reshaping the college football landscape, but it also means they're carrying a financial burden that shouldn't necessarily be theirs. Also, none of these fan collectives addresses the real issue. Players are still being shut out of the larger financial empire that they've built on their own with their own hard work. Ever larger broadcast deals have turned college football into a multi-billion dollar sport, but players are still not sharing in that revenue. Although it's admirable that a Texas nonprofit created a fund that would pay every Texas offensive lineman $50,000 a year with a goal of helping the Longhorns address a team weakness, the university's athletic department reported a staggering $239 million in revenue in 2022, mostly from media rights, ticket sales, and direct contributions. ESPN's current television deal with the college football playoff pays an average of $470 million annually, which enriches tournament organizers, participating schools, and the stadiums where the games are held. Next year, the playoffs will expand from 4 to 12 teams, which could attract, by one estimate, $2.2 billion in media rights fees from multiple television partners. Top schools stand to gain a lot more revenue, but longer playoffs mean the top college athletes take on more risk of injuries that could jeopardize their professional career. That players can accept financial support from fans is an improvement over what used to happen, but the real power brokers are still escaping what should be primarily their obligation. The sham of amateurism was debunked a long time ago, but the college football decision makers continue to insist on maintaining the ruse because, ultimately, they don't want to share the wealth. The NCAA is clearly hoping the day never comes when schools have to directly pay the players a piece of the massive television money they earn, but that day looks more and more inevitable. A class action lawsuit, House versus NCAA, would completely dismantle the unfair system that the college sports governing body has constructed. Lawyers for the University of Arizona swimmer Grant House and other plaintiffs argue that college athletes should be paid for what they have earned before the NIL rules changed in 2021. If the plaintiffs win, there could cease to be any limits on NIL payments to athletes, and the NCAA would be forced to create a revenue-sharing system with the players. The plaintiffs are seeking more than $1.4 billion in damages, $1.3 billion for male athletes, and $50 million for female athletes. Football and men's basketball games generate the largest share of revenue in college sports. The trial is set to begin next January. If the NCAA loses, it will be a fate that the organization has definitely earned. Even if that happens, these collectives probably won't go away. As the expense of college sports continues to grow, schools will need every resource possible to recruit and retain players. But the fans alone can't solve the basic inequity facing student athletes. The NCAA and its member schools need to start paying their fair share. Now, How to Worry Less and Be Happier by Arthur C. Brooks. Everybody has worries. In early 2023, according to the market research firm Ipsos, the five most common worries of people worldwide were inflation, poverty and social inequality, crime and violence, unemployment, and corruption, financial and political. Such surveys ask respondents to choose from a list of typical global problems. In that regard, they no doubt diverge from your personal worries, which might be even greater. A perceived change in your partner's affections, perhaps, or your child's rather mixed performance in school, or that sore spot on the back of your leg. Although worrying a bit is normal for some people, worrying can be a dominant element of a generalized anxiety that steals their peace and sucks up valuable time. I have been worrying and fretting myself, and I don't know what I am doing, says Rodion Raskolnikov, the protagonist of Fyodor Dostoevsky's novel Crime and Punishment. Yesterday and the day before yesterday, and all this time, I have been worrying myself. If you too are a chronic worrier, this will ring familiar. Your loved ones have probably offered you all kinds of true but unhelpful advice, such as, worrying won't help, as if that insight would make you slap your forehead and become worry-free. Maybe you have at times despaired that this condition of anxiety is simply your lot in life. But the cause is not lost. With some knowledge and a bit of practice, you can make 2024 a far less worrisome and thus happier year. Worrying is a recursive mental attempt to resolve a situation that has an uncertain, possible negative outcome. As a mental operation, it is similar to rumination in that both are repetitive and self-focused and feature an inability to shift attention from negative thoughts. Both activities also harm attention, erode problem-solving, and worsen mood. The distinction between them is that rumination typically involves brooding on trouble in the past, whereas worry usually focuses on events that, to your knowledge, have not yet occurred. You ruminate on a bad conversation you had yesterday. You worry about the conversation you need to have tomorrow. A number of psychological theories have been advanced to explain chronic worry. One of the most prominent is called avoidance model, which explains how worry can be obsessive and intrusive in our lives. This model argues that inveterate worriers replace thoughts of clear outcomes of problems, especially potentially catastrophic ones, with a hazy sense of negativity that's harder to act upon. In support of this idea, subsequent research has shown when people prone to worry are shown negative images, the parts of the brain normally associated with processing stimuli, the parietal cortex and the insula, are relatively disengaged. In other words, worrying seems to mute the vividness of our mental picture, interfering with some of the pathways that could help us devise real solutions. Second, the avoidance model suggests that worriers hold a belief that if they think enough about a threat, they will manage to avoid it. Research has revealed that worriers believe that their worrying will help them learn how to handle a situation better or increase their control of it. This conviction also contains an element of superstition, as if worrying per se could somehow ward off negative events and prevent them from occurring. For some people, therefore, worrying is like wearing a pair of lucky socks or carrying around a rabbit's foot. This is similar to the belief that you can jinx someone by talking about it, and equally ineffectiveness. Some evidence suggests that chronic worrying actually has a genetic component. The so-called worrier-warrior gene determines how well catecholamines, neurotransmitters, and hormones released into the body in response to stress are broken down. Worriers have a gene variant that allows them, researchers presume, to process excess dopamine efficiently in areas of the brain associated with working memory. The worrier variant has a different genetic characteristic that may enable superior absorption of neurotransmitters in regions that handle negative information. A person with this variant seems better equipped to be calm under fire. Chronic worriers tend to be people who deal poorly with uncertainty, who struggle with narrowed focus, and are self-conscious and have social anxiety. The good news is that generally the susceptibility to worry declines as we age. A seeming exception to the downside is that worry is positively correlated with high performance, but only among people with unusual levels of ability. You might interpret this as evidence that worrying is good for top-notch performers, but much more probable, in my view, is that such people tend to be in extremely stressful situations anyway, which leads to a lot of apprehension. And in fact, these talented individuals might do even better if they could control their worrying. For them too, as with everyone, worry is terrible for well-being. It is linked to depression, it increases the perception of pain, and it's associated with procrastination and perfectionism. On top of everything else, worrying is not based in reality most of the time. As the Stoic philosopher Seneca noted, we suffer more often in imagination than in reality. His assertion bears up under empirical scrutiny. According to research from 2020 in the journal Behavior Therapy, 91% of the things study participants worried about did not come to pass. This means that for every bad thing that happens, chronic worriers suffer for 10. If nothing else, this is a colossal waste of valuable time, and we should all find ways to avoid it. Easier said than done. If you are a worrier, simply willing it away is something you have probably tried unsuccessfully many times. The science gives us a better strategy based on worry's component parts. 1. Write your worry down. Anxiety, of which worry is a component, is essentially just unfocused fear. Without a true focus, fear is a phantasm that you will struggle to deal with adequately. Much better to focus the fear by articulating it to yourself. You can do this by making a list. When you are worried about a bunch of things, take a sheet of paper and write down the 5 things that you're most anxious about. This is an effective metacognitive technique, as I've written before, thinking about thinking, that defines and puts limits around the sources of your discomfort. Naming them in a list makes them emotionally manageable. 2. Focus on outcomes, not problems. Remember that worry generally focuses on problems but avoids actual outcomes. So you worry about an upcoming medical test but don't admit to yourself what a bad outcome you fear actually is. If you could voice that fear, you would give yourself a chance to think about what you could actually do in that case. So on your worry list, write down the best outcome for each problem, the worst outcome, and the most likely outcome. Then add what you would do in each instance. This makes the source of worry specific and gives you a management plan. With that, you'll be able to park the problem mentally and experience relief from worry. 3. Fight your superstition. Give up the magical thinking that if you torture yourself with enough about some uncertainty, you will somehow improve the situation. Perseverative worry will not give you some unique insight, nor will you alter the universe through the power of your thoughts. This is what your loved ones mean when they tell you worrying won't help. Make this more helpful by telling yourself, "My worrying will not change the course of events," and use the social science outlined in this article to reinforce this rational resolve. 4. Seize the day. Worry robs you of valuable time in your life. When you wake up in the morning, declare your intention to stop spending time this way. Here's what I say: I don't know what this day will bring, but I am alive to experience it and will not waste it worrying about things I cannot control. Another good one is the Serenity Prayer. Will you still worry some? Probably, but this statement of intent can set you on a better course. Research does, in fact, show that this type of mental exercise, which involves identifying specific alternate goal-oriented behavior, promotes goal achievement. One more point. Worriers often beat themselves up for their habit as if worrying were a purely personal failing. One possible countermeasure for a chronic worrier is to ask yourself whether something or someone might be encouraging this in you for some gain of their own. Major economic interests, for example, reside in maintaining a worried population. The one profiting from your worry might be closer still. One of the hallmarks of a toxic relationship is one in which you are purposely or systematically made to feel anxious and fretful, making you more pliable and easier to manipulate. No one is responsible for making your tendency to worry go away, but you in turn have no responsibility to give your support, votes, attention, or affection to someone who will use your anxiety to their advantage. If someone or something is prospering from your worries, 2024 might be the year to declare independence. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and have a great day.